Welcome back to the Scaling Tech Podcast, the podcast for software engineering leaders. I'm your host, Aaron Seib. In today's episode, I'm speaking with Kent McDonald, who's a freelance product manager and writer, who I first met when we were both Agile coaches. He and I both coached teams at a couple of large corporate offices in Des Moines, Iowa. And for about 18 months, I would fly into Des Moines most weeks and work with teams alongside Kent. I learned a lot from working with him, and so I'm really pleased to have him join me in this episode of the Scaling Tech Podcast to talk about product management and Agile in general. As always, please like and follow the Scaling Tech Podcast on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, LinkedIn, or anywhere else you're enjoying this episode. I really appreciate your support and feedback. And let's get on to my interview with Kent.
Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Through expert interviews, we help you navigate the challenges of leading, hiring, growing, and nurturing your tech team to deliver the value your customers demand. Brought to you by agilityfeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally.
Kent J. McDonald is a freelance product manager and writer and a former Agile coach. Kent is a past chair of the Agile Alliance Conference and a co-founder of the Agile Project Leadership Network. He's also author of numerous books and publications on Agile business analysts, strategy roadmaps, and product management. Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, Kent.
Thanks for having me on, Aaron. I appreciate the opportunity.
It's my pleasure. I want to start with one of the biggest problems I've seen personally with product owners. That's the product owner who never takes anything off the backlog. In fact, I've seen teams create a fake backlog of things that will never be done, and everyone knows they will never be done, just to appease that product owner who doesn't want to delete anything. So how do you know when to delete cards from the backlog, and how do you convince people that that needs to be done, perhaps?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that I don't know that it's a fake backlog. I'd say the definition of any backlog is it's got stuff on it that's never going to get done. But that's just from past experience.
Yeah, no doubt.
It's interesting because I've had the opportunity to, as you mentioned, I used to be an Agile coach, and so I've had the opportunity to work with a lot of organizations. Now I pretty much freelance, so oftentimes I'm coming into organizations and seeing the result of them getting inflicted with other advice from other Agile coaches. And if I hear the terms shovel-ready backlog or people passing advice that says you need to have 6 months worth of backlog items in your backlog, my first piece of advice to the folks is to actually, I just look them straight in the eye and say, you need to burn your backlog. And then what that'll usually do is probably start some kind of convulsions, or the eyelids will start twitching or everything.
Right.
and the reason for that is because chances are that when you have, and there's no magic number, but if you have more backlog items in your backlog than you can get done in a couple of in a month, everything past that is going to be inventory that's most likely going to go stale before you can even get a chance to use it. So I do use the kind of very extreme phrase burn the backlog, but in a lot of cases it usually is the best thing to do is just wipe the backlog clean with the thought that if it really important, it would come back.
I want to clarify something you said there, though, and make sure I got this right. I think you said there are Agile coaches telling teams that they need at least 6 months of cards on their backlog. Did I hear that correctly?
It may not be that the coaches are saying that, but the people that are receiving the advice are interpreting
that's
it.
That's what they heard.
Yes, that's what they heard. Maybe that's not what was said, right?
Okay, that's a good distinction.
And then what happens is then, especially in organizations that are just getting started out, is that the folks that maybe look like they know what they're doing, because they're actually moving along and progressing things, then other parts of the organization start getting asking, so what are you doing and how are you doing it? And then they pass along this advice like, well, we've got this very long backlog that it works great because we always have something to do.
Right.
The point they're missing there is that chances are 50-60% of what they're doing is probably the wrong thing and isn't necessary. And they're emphasizing producing output and keeping busy over doing things that actually make a difference.
Yeah. Yeah. Classic problem in any organization, and in software development, certainly I've seen it time and time again of, you know, measuring output via production instead of via value. It's one of those things that, I think like any agile methodology, any process methodology is not a silver bullet, but what agile methods tend to do really well is help make problems more visible that exist in the organization, make it a little bit harder to deny those problems exist. And a 6-month backlog of things that everybody knows are never going to be done is probably one of those red flags of a different problem that exists in the organization. Do you draw a distinction though with that between, like, I would say personally, no problem to have a roadmap of 6 months maybe even a list of epics of some high level material defined for 6 months. But if you've got it down at that story level, that's where you're definitely wasting time. What's your thought on that?
And I would also say that when I have gone to an approach where I kind of the bigger, broader picture I have captured in a roadmap. But my roadmaps don't have any dates on them. So it's now, next, later. Depending on the nature of the organization, I'll have a never, just to be clear about what things we are not going to do.
But
there aren't any necessarily any dates there. But if you look at it, it's probably something that's resembling 6 months to a year. Yeah. Ideally, the things that are on there are more problems to solve or opportunities to exploit, even more so than actual epics, but you got to take what you can get with where the organization is. And because a lot of the things I'm doing is working with organizations that are building software for their own use, the outcomes are a little bit harder to get to, more so than saying that there's some major chunks of things we got to do. So that's the roadmap. Yeah. And then I'm not exploding those things out into smaller backlog items until something pops into the next or into the now column, maybe a little bit in the next just to kind of get things moving. But I really am like, I don't want to have to deal with anything more finite than that. One, because I'm lazy. two, because I know I'm going to understand and learn things along the way that, again, if I get to breaking things out in backlog items too soon, it's going to be based on old data. I'm going to find out new things. It's like, well, that was just a wasted effort. So that way I keep my actual backlog fairly short and small.
I like that. I really like on the roadmap side how you describe you want the items in there primarily to be a list of problems to solve or opportunities. That makes a lot of sense. And then the other thing that I can imagine happening is, you know, in that sort of now later columns, I like that you're trying to avoid timelines. I can also see common scenarios in a business, whereas they're kind of doing some annual planning or quarterly planning, and there's other, outside factors like, you know, the trade show they want to exhibit something at, that's a set date of being able to say, okay, we would really like to have XYZ thing for the investor call or the trade show or whatever it is that doesn't budge. I can see some of that being put in there, but, you know, that's a little bit opening the door, problems too, right? Especially if that becomes seen as a commitment that the team is making when they, you know, shouldn't be fully committing to anything until it gets down to that now column and into sprints, right?
Yeah. So when I have obviously been asked for dates quite a bit, I use a different mechanism. At that point, I'm using a release plan. And if I'm going to pull one of those out, it's going to vary on the nature of the thing I'm working on. So prime example, a couple years ago, I was working with a team where we were rebuilding a internal app that an organization used to price. Well, it was an agriculture company, and they were rebuilding a tool that was 20 years old, built in Power Builder with all of the wonderful things that had implies.
Right.
And so we were rebuilding that, and the nature of their business processes was such that it wasn't something that you could be running in two systems at the same time. Because there was basically, they wanted to have one source of truth as far as what prices they were setting for the corn, wheat, and soybean that they were buying to turn around and then sell. So we had a definitive date that we wanted to switch over because of the growing cycles and everything that goes along with their business cycles, says this is the date that makes sense. It just so happened to be April 1st, 2020. So few things going on there, you know, who wants
few
to release,
things happened, yeah.
Who wants to release a system on April Fool's Day? And besides the fact that it was 2 weeks after, and the team I was working with, we had been co-located working together in the same room and all things until the middle of the March, a couple of weeks before that.
Right.
So,
right.
In that situation, and on top of that, because we were shifting over from an old system to a new system, there was a certain set of functionality that had to be there. Plus, we were wanting to add some new capabilities. And what we were able to do as we were working through it is we realized that there was a subset of capabilities that we were needing for that first quarter, or actually be second quarter of the year, to do what they were needing to do at that point. So those are the things we emphasized first. And we did use a release plan that had dates. So it would be the closest up things were maybe a couple of sprints we kind of specified out, and then it went to months, and then it went to quarters after that. So gradually broader periods of time, again, to indicate the uncertainty we had. But that we use that to communicate through, because saying, here's where things are at, to make sure we had the stuff in line that we need to have there. We're going to be there. That worked well for that situation. If we didn't have those specific dates, I don't know that I would have done that, because it wouldn't be necessary. And again, it would be, as you said, it would be making commitments that writing checks that my team couldn't cash. So right. We have to always think about what situation are you in, and what's that balancing act between setting the right expectations, but giving the folks that you're working with the information that they need.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you jokingly earlier said that, you know, waiting to refine stories is due to laziness, but there's a fine line between laziness, procrastination, and efficiency in this area, right? We want to do things at the last responsible moment, right, is the term that's often used for this, but not because we're trying to be as close to irresponsible as possible, but because that's the point where we have the most information about what mm-hmm. actually needs to be done and what is actually valuable. So let's back up a little bit and share a little bit more with our listeners about yourself, about your background as a business analyst and product manager, how you got into agile coaching, and sort of mm-hmm. your journey to what you're doing today.
Yeah, it was funny in the intro you were reading. It was like, man, that stuff I was doing like 15 years ago. This is going back in the good old days. So my path into business analysis, we'll start there, was interesting. I actually got a degree in industrial engineering, and right out of college, I was working as a wiring harness engineer for General Motors, or division of General Motors. My wife and I decided, after a couple of years of being out in the Ohio area, we wanted to move back home to Iowa. And there isn't much auto manufacturing or anything in the auto world going on there except for car dealerships. So had to make a switch. And I had been doing some project management of some of the bigger wiring harness programs when I was out working in that. So I said, okay, well, I'll find something along those lines, some project management related things. So I got a job at a IT consulting firm, and said, well, yeah, you've got some project management experience, but it's not in IT. So we need to give you something that kind of gets you into it. So we're going to have you do this thing called business analyst. I'm like, okay, whatever. and this was in 98. And so that's before like IIBA had come into existence and everything. But so it was an existing role, but it wasn't really clearly defined. And I got into it and I found out, you know, I like doing this stuff. I mean, I was working on an MBA at the time. I was really dealing with trying to figure out business problems. So for a while, I shifted back and forth, working through all the different main places you work at in IT in Des Moines, which there are more than you'd think. Either doing project management, business analyst, or both, usually found myself gravitating towards business analysis. And then around 2003, I was walking through Barnes & Noble, and I happened to, Scott Ambler loves when I tell this story, I happened to walk past the discount book table. You know how Barnes & Noble used to have those tables? And there was Scott Ambler's Agile Modeling sitting there. So I picked it up and was looking through and like, this kind of describes what I do. I don't know that I've ever called it that. So I bought that Reddit. And interesting enough, in the back at that point, he had listed a bunch of Yahoo groups. Again, man, I'm calling my age here. And one of them was this Agile project management group that a guy by the name of Jim Highsmith had started. And so I just, not knowing any better, just, you know, signed up to join. It turns out it was a private group that he was trying to get some people together that were going to go to the Agile Development Conference in 2004 about starting a group similar to the Agile Alliance about project leadership, project management, and Agile. I just kind of horned my way in. And then started going to that Agile conference for a while. Meanwhile, back at my day gigs, no one was even talking about Agile. So I would just kind of introduce these things in guerrilla fashion here and there.
Right.
And as I got more involved with the Agile conferences with Agile Alliance and helped start up the Agile Project Leadership Network, I started making some connections. And then after a while, got some opportunities to do Agile coaching. And so kind of for a while there, I was doing that as my main gig, going around helping companies learn it. And again, I was coming at it from more the business side of it. So the product owner role was kind of a natural fit for me. And then I did that for a few years, had an opportunity to work as a staff member for Agile Alliance on the submission system and the, and again, another system rebuild. I somehow managed to attract system rebuilds as my main gig, I guess.
Lucky you.
Lucky me. So I was a product owner for that. And then along those times is when product management was really making a big inroads into software development, certainly in the tech. It had been in the tech world for a while, but now starting to show up in the larger enterprises that were, again, building software for their own use. And so I moved over to product management, which is where I've been since then. Usually going in and helping organizations that are starting to dabble with the product operating model, but doing it more as a player coach, if you will. So primarily going in there and doing the job, but then helping out folks along the way as well. And then all throughout there, picked up the writing bug, wrote a few books, had the most interesting scenario of writing the first one, co-writing with three other people who were all at least 10 years my senior in terms of experience. So I was mostly the one that was doing most of the writing, and they were the ones bringing all the ideas to it. And then I was able to spring out and do a couple of my own after that.
Yeah, that must have been an interesting experience from a writer's perspective, writing by committee, essentially.
Yes.
I've known you for a long time, but I didn't know about your early background in auto manufacturing. Mm-hmm. That must have led to a little bit of extra credibility when you're talking to people about Lean and Kaizen and say, I've been on the factory floor. I know what we're talking about here in this old, you know, Toyota way that we talk about.
Yeah, I had actually had some classes in my undergrad in industrial engineering about quality control. And I already knew about Deming and all that. And then the platform I supported when I was building wiring harnesses was Saturn. So obviously there was a lot of built-in good practices from a manufacturing perspective there. So when I started seeing this stuff in software development, I'm like, well, yeah, of course you'd do that. Why wouldn't you? I mean, it was so second nature to me. I'm like, well, why wouldn't you go about doing it that way? Right. But it was interesting trying to translate it from a manufacturing scenario that once something is designed, the process of building it is rinse and repeat. Whereas in software development, the process of building it is, oh, I'm going to push this button and compile now.
Right.
And it's the vast majority of the effort is actually done in design. So in some cases, it makes sense to apply lean ideas and pull ideas from manufacturing to apply to software development. But in other cases, it's like, well, you're really talking about two different things here. The emphasis is in a different area of the overall life cycle of putting a product together. So some of the things that you say, well, it works in manufacturing great, don't necessarily apply too much to software development, because every time you're building something new, you're creating something new from a software perspective, it's a whole new set of challenges that you're dealing with, as opposed to, well, once we've got it designed, we're just cranking out widgets left, right, and center.
Yeah, that's true. We rarely do something twice in right. software development. Sometimes we think we do, and we think we're reusing things. And to a degree, you know, we can like abstract things out and reuse that code. But it's very rare that you're truly doing something twice, I would say. There's always a lot of creativity in it. So that's an interesting observation. Can you have any specific examples in mind of things that, you know, you learned in industrial engineering or in manufacturing that would not, you know, you would say definitely don't carry over, or maybe people try to carry over and they shouldn't?
Well, I think it goes back to the stated goal of wanting to be efficient, but what that turns into is we need to keep the people that are doing the main maker work busy. Which means, are our developers busy? But
right.
a busy developer does not look like a busy person on the factory floor, right?
Yeah.
Person on the factory floor is, and especially like, for example, when Saturn was a going concern, the way that, and most manufacturers do that, car manufacturers do this, is you've got someone, you're actively putting a wiring harness in and you're standing on the platform that's moving down the assembly line. You get the wiring harness put in, then you walk down and get the next car and you start working on that one. A very busy developer might be sitting there staring at the ceiling for half an hour trying to puzzle through something.
And, that's true.
And someone looking at it from the outside is going to be thinking, well, that person's not doing anything.
Right.
When in fact, they're like seriously burning some mental calories trying to figure out some big problem. So that's the one that immediately comes to mind is that busy looks different between software development or even analysis or product management for that matter, compared to someone building a car.
It's a great observation. I mean, when I was a more hands-on software developer, I went on a lot of walks outside to help think through problems that fortunately my managers were okay with me doing and understood it was part of my process. But yeah, in a manufacturing context, I'd get fired pretty quick for that, yeah. I imagine.
I want to take a moment to tell you about our sponsor, WebRTC Ventures. At WebRTC Ventures, our teams are experts in building live video into your web or mobile applications. We've literally built hundreds of them. We have over a decade of experience using both open source and commercial media servers in a wide range of industries, including telehealth, edtech, broadcasting, and more. We also publish a lot of helpful tips and industry interviews on our website and our YouTube channel. So be sure to check out webrtc.ventures and we can help you build, scale, and deploy your video solution.
Now, you've mentioned a couple of times that your specialization in product management is for companies that are building products for their own use, mm-hmm. as opposed to selling them, I believe. Tell me a little bit more about that distinction, what you're drawing there and why that's your focus.
Yeah, I'll start with the second part of that question. It's my focus because that's where I've worked most of the time. And so, and one of the things that I always had this thing in the background when I was an agile coach, and it might be why I kind of moved away to more being a player coach, is that it didn't make sense for me to coaching someone else on something I hadn't done. Mm-hmm. So it became very apparent that I was always more working on the product, on the business side of things, and how are we solving a business problem with technology. I mean, and I felt comfortable picking up technology because of my technical background, but I've never been a honest to goodness developer. So I'm usually always learning enough to either know when I'm being BS'd,
right,
and then also to be able to talk with the rest of the team so that we can work through solving problems together. So it's the reason I focus there is because that's what I know. That's where I've been.
Yeah.
The distinction is that, There are a lot of things that carry over from product management as it's practiced originally in consumer product goods and then in tech products to how it can be done when an organization custom builds software for their own use. There are a lot of practices that product managers use that could be useful inside, and it's a lot around making sure you're not building stuff you shouldn't be building. Not doing stupid things, as my friend Neil Nicolaisen would say. And because that doesn't tend to always happen a lot. So organizations that need that are saying, well, okay, we need to go more digital. We need to go through these digital transformations. We need to bring technology more to into all parts of our business. That's great, but what they often forget to do is make some key decisions about, does this thing make sense to build versus buy? Mm-hmm. And then if they're building it, say, who is it that's really identifying what it is we're building and why, right? And what usually happens in most organizations is it's the folks that are in the particular business unit that are needing some sort of technology to help them with their business process that are identifying, here's what we need to do. So they're kind of explaining the why, which is great. And then they take it a step further. And because, and even depending on how technology savvy they are, they're always usually going to describe it in terms of something they're familiar with, which half the time is going to be Excel.
So, right.
So that, and a lot, and IT organizations, because they're gradually coming into actually building software, but they're coming from a realm of where they were more of a cost center, where they are more of a service organization. They're used to basically taking requests that they get at face value, because often it was more, we need these technology assets, we need them deployed, we need them configured, da 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 da. And they're not sitting there thinking, well, yeah, we could do it that way, but there's probably a more effective way of doing it. And so the whole idea of incorporating product management ideas into organizations, and a lot of times this is called internal products, organizations building software themselves, is having some of those, that the decision-making capabilities where the right people are making the decisions about what it is we should be building and what we shouldn't. The idea of doing more actual discovery, not just going out with a waiter pad saying, what are your requirements, but actually trying to understand the problem and find out what are the constraints that we need to do. So, I mean, my second book was called Beyond Requirements, because I was really trying to encourage people that do business analysis work to stop thinking of themselves as requirements jockeys and actually trying to go out and understand what problem we're trying to solve and what are some of the constraints around the solution that we can create. Not asking, what do you want, but, you know, what is it you're trying to accomplish?
Right. What's the problem you're trying to solve? Yeah, that's great. And I guess that's one advantage perhaps of doing internal product management is that you, I imagine you have easier access to your customers to do kind of like, you know, user is the term I should use instead of customer, but like your user research is a little more accessible to you.
Yeah, that's a blessing and a curse. your users are definitely more accessible to you. They're also a lot closer if they're not happy.
Right. You're also more accessible to them.
Yes, you're also more accessible to them. And then the another thing that comes from adopting product is also the how your teams are organized. Because often what a lot of organizations did when they start off is they'd have, here's the team of the people that are lucky enough to build the new creative fun stuff. And then once it's built, we're going to chuck it over the wall to these other poor saps that have to support it.
Right.
And they're getting handed all of the quick mistakes and tech debt that seemed like a good idea to introduce on the when we're building it side, but then because they don't have to deal with the consequences of it after the fact. So one of the things that adopting a product operating model does is says, okay, as a team, you build it, you own it, which has a couple of different benefits. One is you're not losing the knowledge of what came about when you're building it. And second of all, chances are people are going to be a little bit more careful about what they introduce in the first place because they know they're going to have to support it after the fact. So it changes the decision-making a little bit there.
Yeah, and for those who may not be familiar, can you take a moment to kind of define a product operating model and what that means for the people who are implementing it?
Sure. The term has specifically product operating model has become in vogue over the last couple of years. Depending on how you view it, you can either thank or blame Marty Kagan for coining the term.
Right. Yep.
And granted, I have some differences in thought and how he approaches describing it, but the kind of what he describes is very good. It's effectively taking the way that product or tech product companies operate and moving that into these organizations that build software for their own use. And it effectively comes down to how you decide what you're going to work on. I'm paraphrasing here. How you actually build the products and how you organize to do that are kind of the very broad swaths of it. In an ideal setting, what that means is that you're making decisions focused on outcomes. So, you know, what are we trying to accomplish? Why are we doing this? Deciding what you're going to build based on that. You've got a team of a stable, dedicated team that own a thing, a product or an asset, that are empowered, that instead of being handed solutions to deliver, they're instead asked to solve problems. So basically the scope that gets tossed over the wall to them is not implement the CRM system. It's how might we better interact with our customers or better track how our customers are operating. And then the team themselves are there situated to figure out how are we going to do this. And then that team consists of people looking at things from a variety of different perspectives, ultimately charged with figuring out how they're going to address four key risks: value, viability, usability, and feasibility. So feasibility, can we build it with who we have here? Usability, will the customer, where our users actually use it, and are they able to use it? Value is, does it solve a customer's problem? And viability means, it does it make sense for our organization to do it? And will it fit in? And this is where I've kind of tweaked it a little bit with viability, is, does it fit in with how our business operates?
Right, right.
And so that's a natural place I have kind of concluded lately where business analysts can play a big role, is because they typically understand the process, data, and rules that a business operates under. And that has a big factor in whether or not something is viable for that organization. Oh,
that makes a lot of sense. And thank you. That's a great summary of the product operating model. And kind of going back to the opening question I had for you about how do you deal with someone who has this huge backlog of things that will never be done. If you were implementing those criteria around a product operating model, that's going to probably help filter a lot that down. And having seen Marty Kagan speak and interacting with him a little bit, I'd love to have him be the person who's telling that product owner, you got to cut all this shit out of here, because he's a pretty pretty direct speaking guy. I could imagine that would be a fun conversation to listen into. But while we're defining things, let's talk a little bit about the difference between a product owner, product manager, business analyst. Help us understand sort of the differences in those roles.
This is a conversation that I would have thought would have been figured out a few years ago, but it still hasn't. And let's talk about the product owner, product manager first. And I think part of the reason the conversation has not died down is because you've got two different communities that have definitive views as far as what things mean. From one perspective, you have the Agile community, and frankly, the most vocal folks in there are the Scrum subset, because product owner is a role coming from Scrum that basically say, well, the product owner is a role, and product managers fill the product owner role, and everything's good and jolly, and just call them product owners, it'll be fine. I want to believe, but I could be making this up, and I haven't looked lately to find out if there's an actual source, that I want to think that when Ken Schwaber was originally creating or describing Scrum, not creating it, he chose product owner to get a little bit away from product managers, because some of the product managers he had interacted with back in the 90s were less than enjoyable to work with. So he kind of wanted to separate from that idea. And so his idea, I think the idea behind how the product owner role is described as Scrum has a lot to do with what Scrum is intended to do, which is basically, let's take a look at all the different problems that development teams have and figure out ways to solve them. One of the biggest challenges they had was conflicting directions, not having clear idea what it is they need to be doing. So they say, I got it. Let's have this role. In Scrum, it's called product owner. In XP, it was called the customer, because the XP originally built up around a payroll system for Chrysler, I believe. And so it was consultants in there working for, again, building software internally. Yeah. So we're going to have this role and they're going to be responsible for guiding us in what we need to build. Perfect. From a developer perspective, I suspect that's great. You know, give us just enough guidance, give us priorities, be there to answer questions. How you figure that all out, I don't know. We don't know how to do that. You know how to do that. That's why you're the product owner. Go off and be happy.
Right. And give me only one of you.
And give me only one of you.
Negotiate between people.
Yes. I don't want to have these arguments. And so on the other token, you've got, and so product owner ends up becoming this fairly finitely defined thing that's basically a product person who's working with the development team. Definitely a very important activity that needs to happen. Product management, on the other hand, is saying there's a lot more to product than just that. You got to, I mean, and so it's the whole discovery delivery thing. You got to go out, you got to talk to customers, you got to understand the problem, all of these things. Effectively explaining how to do the product stuff that Scrum didn't tell the product owners how to do, right? You would think that these two would be very complementary. But what happens is that then you get organizations that may or may not be getting good advice about what you label the people doing certain things and where you bring them from and how you source them. And then you get, some organizations that say, we just have product managers and they do combination of understanding the market, working with the development team, which is, by the way, what the product management community would say would be the only, some of the people in the product management community would be the only way you should do things. Then you've got product owners, you got the agile community saying, well, it's important that they're there telling, you know, help giving guidance to the development team. They're available for the development team. Again, we don't care how you do it. So you can go out and talk to users if you want to, as long as you're there to answer questions for the development team so we don't get stuck.
Yeah.
And then you have some organizations that say, they don't say it, but we like title inflation. So we're going to have both. And then there are some frameworks that institutionalize that in a very regimented way, which may or may not be safe. And then you have this separation where you've got product managers who are supposedly out looking at the market, figuring out, doing the discovery, figuring out what it is we need to build. And then in effect, they chuck it over the wall to the product owners that are working with the team because there's just too much to do for one person to do that all. You know, never mind that there are other ways to slice product responsibilities so that you could have that. And you have these arguments, and what a lot of the product owners are right. No, it should be product managers. So you shouldn't have product owners. What most of those are forgetting is that there's probably different contexts where each of those different models that I suggested might make sense. Mm-hmm. And instead you get the discussion happening at the very broad level. So what it usually ends up is product management is probably closer related to a job title that does the full set of figuring out, you know, what is it we should, you know, what problem are we trying to solve? How are we going to do that? Working with both the market and the development team to make it happen. Product owner is, as it was initially defined, was a role specifically the product aspect of working with the development team. And then in some cases, as I mentioned, product manager fills the product owner role. In some organizations, they choose to separate them out, maybe or maybe not realizing the benefits and disadvantages of doing that and figuring that out and how that happens. And so that's kind of how I look at it. To roll the business analyst into it, as I mentioned before, they're the folks, the good ones, are the ones that understand the business rules, processes, and data that an organization needs to operate. And so they tend to be more into the more specifics about defining and describing solutions. They're usually much more focused on the solution aspect of things than the problem space and figuring out what it is we need to do. Although, when you have business analysis skills, it's an easy leap to kind of expand out into more of that product management world.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd love to dive into that in more detail with you, but I know we have a lot of other questions I want to get to you. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to point out to our listeners that you also have a blog post up on your site, insideproduct.co, about this, about moving between business analyst, product owner, product management roles and distinctions there. So we'll make sure to link to that in the show notes episode today at scalingtechpod.com. But let's talk. One thing I want to make sure to ask you about, because a lot of our listeners are engineering managers. And so I want to ask you, what can an engineering, what's something that engineering leadership can do, can focus on in order to work well with product management? How can those sorts of roles best support each other?
Mm-hmm. Good question. And one of the big things is figure out, it's actually taking a look at that product owner role and what the expectations are around that. Because some organizations, what they'll do, and this is actually what I was doing on that project I mentioned earlier about the pricing system for the agriculture company, is mm-hmm. they'll have this role called delivery lead, which is an amalgamation between a bit of scrum master, a bit of product owner, a bit of business analyst. And they are truly minding the gap, if you will, to make sure that the team has what they need in order to keep moving forward. Things are progressing. Oftentimes it's kind of coaching along the way of, good practices to do from a work management standpoint of Agile, not necessarily the technical practices, which are also extremely important. One of the models where if you want to have a product manager that's able to kind of do the full scope of both work focusing on discovery and delivery and have time to do both well, often is well supported by an engineering manager that's doing a lot of the kind of more focusing more on the delivery aspect, potentially even doing some of the things along the lines that product owners might do or scrum masters might do, where it's coordinate if you have a lot of dependencies with their teams, coordinating with those types of things. And so one of the things I think that product managers assume when they say you don't need product owners is they've got an engineering manager doing some of those things that product owners end up picking up. And so when that doesn't happen, that's often why a product owner exists there. So a lot of it is, and way I've always approached things is I look at even job titles and roles as suggestions or as a starting point to say, here's what we kind of expect different folks to do. But everybody comes to the job with their own background, skills, experience, knowledge, biases, all of that kind of things. So one of the things I first like to do is sit down and say, I know that I should be doing these things and you should be doing these things. But I also, let's talk about what you're good at, what you maybe some of your weaknesses are, where we may complement each other. And let's figure out, granted, that's what the roles should be doing. Let's figure out what we're actually going to do and who's going to own it. Where are we going to cooperate on things? Where are we going to share? Have that discussion early on and then be willing to reflect on that on an ongoing basis. And not being so precious about my territory and your territory, but more along the lines of how can we work together to make sure we ultimately get that outcome accomplished that we're trying to get to.
Yeah, I love that. Definitely a very good, agile principle there to adhere to. That collaboration is more important for sure. And so setting that early in a relationship between, say, an engineering manager and a product manager, really important because, one of the things you mentioned earlier that I think is a good example of areas where those sorts of roles really need to have a strong collaborative relationship is when you're thinking about build versus buy, mm-hmm. which I think, for an internal product can be particularly challenging and particularly important decision too, because, somewhat stereotypically, the engineering manager is probably going to want to build because that's more interesting than buying and integrating somebody else's product, but obviously not always the right decision. But to make that decision, you've got to have a balance of the technical and enterprise architectural concerns, as well as user discovery and, would an off-the-shelf tool actually meet what the customers need and how do the users need and how do we determine that? So it's got to be a strong basis of collaboration between those mm-hmm. roles and scenarios like that. So that brings me to, you know, and you made a good safe pun earlier, so I'll continue it here a little bit here with my final question, and ask you about how should a team handle external stakeholders who also have a strong influence on development priorities. So it could be in a build buy scenario, like we just mentioned, could be security officers, compliance officers. There's a lot of different roles that, especially in a larger organization or regulated industries, are incredibly important, but certainly not addressed by models like Scrum directly. So how do you think a team should handle that? What's the role of the product manager in that?
So this is actually going to circle back in a strange way back to your very first question. So one of the ways that backlogs become so big is that it's easy to fall in the trap to think that anytime you get requests, be it from users, be it from customers, if you're building for external folks, or in the area I play in and related to your question, stakeholders that have varying levels of influence, is to treat everything they say as a actual requirement, right? Something that has to be done.
And that's probably how the compliance officer is going to phrase it.
Exactly.
That it is a requirement.
Exactly. I have found that it helps for me to start using the phrase requirements or feedback. Requests or feedback. Even to the point where, and this is actually maybe where that faux backlog comes into play, is I actually have started keeping feedback pieces separate from the actual backlog. So, and you can be getting feedback from a whole slew of places. What happens when you're in an internal situation? One of the coping mechanisms tends to be someone comes to you with a request, be it the security architect or the executive assistant of the director for the business unit you're working for, with a request. You say, oh, don't worry, I'll put that on the backlog, which is a coping mechanism for saying is I'm just going to write it down so I don't forget it, but I'm not going to worry about it ever again. Right. Instead, it's let's put these things in a separate pile, list, whatever you, that's more feedback focused. And then a way to actively filter all of that stuff into the real gold mine that is the things that, yeah, we should be doing, is to, on a regular basis, go through that and see, are there some trends we're noticing? Are there some patterns? Are there consistent requests about things that we should be doing? Because remember, oftentimes when you're getting stuff from stakeholders or users, they're phrasing the request in the form of a solution. The system should do this. The system should have a red button that spins when you press it and whatever. Right. By having those feedback separate and actively doing some sort of analysis as you're saying, does this something actually apply? You're able to go through it and throw it against some filters to say, does this actually make sense or not? So as part of that, you'd handle your things from those stakeholders along those same lines. And you may weight the feedback from certain stakeholders higher than others, depending on the subject matter of that request. So if I've got a security architect saying, and I'm not going to even try and give a real specific example because I'll show my ignorance about security technology, but if they're giving suggestions that are highly related to security, of the system, I'm going to probably weight that higher than if they come in and say, you know what, I don't like the look of that interface right there, right? Okay, that, fine, great. Thank you for the feedback. I'm going to keep that over there. But if they're saying, you know, from an architectural standpoint, we're moving over to this new framework to provide security. Okay, yeah, we probably should pay attention to that, right? Yeah. So it's an understanding about different stakeholders have different emphasis and have different decision-making responsibilities in different areas. So mm-hmm. I'm going to pay a lot more attention to what the architect says about general infrastructure things and a lot less about what the interface looks like, as an example.
Yeah. That makes sense. Well, Kent, This has been a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate it. We are out of time, but I do want to just take a quick moment and thank you on a personal level. Over a decade, though I won't say how much over a decade ago, you and I both worked as Agile coaches with some of the same clients. I had an opportunity to travel out to Des Moines a lot during that time period. And not only did you help me find some of the best restaurants to go to after the workday was over, but really, you know, learned a lot just from watching you and how you coached others. And so I really appreciated that time. And it's great to, you know, everything that you taught me, I appreciate. And it's great to reconnect you with you a little bit today. For those listening, you know, I want to make sure to point out there's a lot that Kent talks about. Definitely check him out on LinkedIn. We didn't get to talk about it today, but you were chairing the accelerating product track at the mm-hmm. Agile 2024 conference this year. A lot of great posts up on your LinkedIn about summarizing different sessions from that conference. So it's a great way to see a little bit about what's going on in that world right now. What other ways can our audience learn more about your work, Kent?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me start off by saying thanks for reaching out and having me on the podcast. And there are a few things I picked up. There are quite a few things I picked up from you while we were coaching together, especially around the right order to build and not build stuff that I still use today. So I really appreciate that.
Oh, thank you.
So the couple of best places to keep up to speed with what I'm up to. One, certainly LinkedIn. Reach out there if you're so inclined, and when you, if you send a connection request, send me a little note to say, hey, I heard you on the podcast. The other place is insideproduct.co. It's my website where I put a lot of things out there. And I have a newsletter on Substack, also called Inside Product, where I, on a regular basis, put out content and helpful, pragmatic, hopefully, advice for people that are working in organizations building software for their own use. So if you're a business analyst, product owner, product manager working in insurance company, financial services, healthcare, or any of those kind of organizations, check it out.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Kent. We'll be sure to link to all of that in the show notes on scalingtechpod.com. And thank you once again for joining me today on the Scaling Tech Podcast.
All right. Thanks for having me.
On behalf of the thousands of developers we've placed with our clients, I want to briefly tell you about our sponsor, Agility Feed. Agility Feed has been building nearshore agile teams for U.S. companies since 2010. We were an early pioneer in doing this sort of developer staffing. Our team can help you recruit talented software engineers and technical teams in Latin America. We'll handle all aspects of recruiting, contracting, and payments for you so you can focus on delivering great software. To learn more, check us out at agilityfeet.com. That's agilityfeat.com.